That's a metaphor.
Well, I wonder if that's
a good start.
We're in trouble.
A great start.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor to order this Monday, December 12th, 2016. We've got a couple of presentations this morning, three actually, and we do have a work session to introduce committee legislative concepts for pre-session filing. And we're going to get that business out of the way so I don't forget it later on. And with that, I'll open a work session. Representative Barton, would you like to make a motion?
Chair Holy, so this is going to be a long motion because there's about 25 bills.
Just make one motion for all of them.
It's going to be, so bear with me, everybody. This is my last official act, I gather. So, Chair Holby, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. 2325, dated November 23rd, 2016. 2362, dated December 6th, 2016. 2437, dated November 29th, 2016. 2446, dated November 21st, 2016. 2489, dated November 3rd, 2016. 2506, dated November 11th, 2016. 2519, dated December 2nd, 2016. 2552, dated November 4th, 2016. 2583, dated December 2nd, 2016. 2600, dated December 2nd, 2016. 2601, dated November 22nd, 2016. 2684, dated December 5th, 2016. 2685, dated November 7th, 2016. We're about halfway. 2710.
Take a breath.
2710, dated October 25th, 2016. 2774, dated October 20th, 2016. 2806, dated November 2nd, 2016. 2812, dated December 5th, 2016. 2825, dated October 11th, 2016. 2845, dated November 1st, 2016. 2895, dated November 9th, 2016. 2916, dated November 8th, 2016. 2931, dated October 12, 2016. 2932, dated December 5th, 2016. 2952, dated October 19th, 2016. 2970, dated November 30th, 2016. And 2990, dated October 25th, 2016. I move that they be introduced as legislative concepts as committee bills.
Representative Barton moved that the LCs that he just read off be introduced as a committee bills, and time for a little bit of discussion. This motion doesn't indicate whether you support or oppose the particular measure being introduced. It just allows us to have these introduced for further consideration. Is there any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman, just a comment if I could. Yes,
certainly.
I appreciated you clarifying. I think I expect that all of us will support these as an opportunity for discussion, and it does not imply necessarily support for the actual bill, and we'll have those debates at a more appropriate time.
Thank you. I couldn't have said it better.
It's recorded. Excellent.
Yeah,
thank you.
So if there's no objection, the motion passes. With that, I'll close the work session. And we'll open an informational meeting. And first up, we will have a report from the Oregon Retirement Savings Board. And we do have a time clock to keep us on schedule. So up first, State Treasurer Ted Wheeler. Lisa Messina, I hope I said that right. She's the Executive Director of the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan, and Joel Metlin, Analyst for the Oregon State Treasury. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. Thanks for having us back. It's good to see all of you back as well. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. For about two more weeks, I am the treasurer for the state of Oregon. I'm also here in my capacity as the chair of the Oregon Retirement Savings Board. We've spent countless hours working hard to get this right and to take into account some of the questions and testimony that you've asked us previously. We believe we have done that. Serving with me on that board are Kara Backus, Kevin Jensen, Juanita Santana, Corey Streisinger, Senator Beyer, and Representative Reed, some of whom are here today. We obviously, as I said, worked hard to make sure that we got this right for everybody, for employers, for workers, for people who process payroll. I'm joined today by Lisa Messina. She's the director of the program, and Joel Metlin. They'll be walking you through this brief presentation shortly. But first, I wanted to give you a little bit of preliminary groundwork. First, I want to thank you. I want to thank you, and I want to thank the legislature for passing the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan back in 2015. That was based on some extensive work done by a work group that I had the privilege to chair. It addresses a very significant need in the state of Oregon. By way of some context, the retirement savings deficit in the United States, that's the difference between what people have actually saved for retirement versus what they should have saved for retirement, is estimated to be in the trillions of dollars. By some estimates, it's about 14 times larger than the student financial debt situation. How much do you need to save? There's different formulas used by professionals, but one popular one says you should have saved for your retirement about eight times your annual earnings. So if you earn about $50,000 a year as a household, your household should have approximately $400,000 squirreled away. So how are we doing? In the state of Oregon, the average household savings is currently about $3,000. By way of context, people say you should expect to retire for 20 to 30 years. That $3,000 in household savings will buy you about a month and a half of rent currently in the city of Portland, Oregon. The federal statistics aren't much better. According to the U.S. Federal Reserve, mean retirement household savings in the United States is statistically zero. It's about $2,000. But that doesn't speak much when you think about the number I gave you a moment ago in terms of what you do need to have squirreled away. Against that backdrop, there are three facts that I want you to be aware of that are the basis for the report you received already. First of all, fact one, people are 15 times more likely to save for retirement, and they're more likely to save more if they have access to a retirement plan through their place of employment, 15 times more likely. Fact number two, half the Oregon workforce, or over 1 million people, do not have access to a retirement savings program through their place of employment. 1 million people. That 1 million people has amongst it a disproportionate representation of women, people of color, and people with a high school diploma or less education. Fact number three, if we cannot improve retirement savings in the state of Oregon, it is going to crush us financially. It will impact families and it will impact our communities. If we cannot find effective ways to encourage people to save their own resources voluntarily for their own retirement, the cost to taxpayers in Oregon will be staggering as more and more people instead rely on costly government safety net programs. That's a trend that is already underway, and it means that there will be even less resources for education and public safety and health care. And it also means we're going to start pitting investments in younger generations against the needs of older generations. The Oregon Retirement Savings Plan represents a smart and measured response to these three facts. It's going to be targeted only towards those who do not have access to a retirement plan at their place of employment. It will help create a new generation of savers, and it will reduce reliance on taxpayer funding and reduce the competition for dollars. And at the same time, as mandated by the legislation, it will not create any fiduciary risk for employers. Finally, there was some confusion about this, so I want to make sure this is crystal clear. This is not PERS. This is not in any way connected to PERS. This is not a pension system. This is a plan that reduces the barriers to saving to help people save their own funds for their own retirement. So for the past 18 months, we've been kicking the tires hard. We've been working together. We've been talking to experts around the country. We've been talking to businesses, to employers, to others. And the bottom line is this, and this is reflected in your report. The plan is financially and legally feasible. The goal of the plan is to make sure that people who want to save through their place of employment can do so, and it's to make sure that it's simple, simple for employers, minimize the paperwork, make sure that there is a payroll deduction program similar to the way that people currently, employers currently pay payroll taxes, and again, they'll have no fiduciary risk or fees to pay. For employees, it's about keeping it as simple as possible, keeping the investment options simple, keeping the interface simple, because if people are intimidated, they will choose to opt out. We know that, and opting out is a complete right for employees under the terms of this contract. We submitted a full and detailed report to you on December 1st. It outlined our progress to date. The report you received was supported unanimously by the Oregon Retirement Savings Board. Finally, I want to say this. From the bottle bill to the beach bill to the motor voter registration bill, Oregon has a reputation for leading. And I'm proud to report today that because of the work by the Treasury team and the work by the Oregon Retirement Savings Board, we're on track to be the nation's first state-sponsored retirement savings plan when we go live as scheduled on July 1st. I want to thank you again for your interest and support. I'm going to stay up here, but I'm going to turn this over to Lisa and Joel to walk us through the presentation.
Perfect. Thank you, Treasurer. For the record, I'm Lisa Messina. I'm the director of your retirement savings plan. I have had a number to meet and speak with many of you, so we're going to, and those that I haven't, I'm looking forward to it. We're going to go through some of the next details fairly quickly. If we're going too quickly, please stop us and slow us down and ask any questions that are coming up. So, as noted by the Treasurer, HB 2960 paved the way for a simple, voluntary, workplace-based retirement plan for Oregonians lacking access to a savings option through their place of employment. The plan's use of best practices is going to make it easy for Oregonians to participate and save. Some of those best practices include things like automatic enrollment, contributions through payroll deduction, that the assets are professionally managed, and the concept of a portable account, or really one account for life. Here's something to remember and something I'm very personally excited about. Because of this plan, in a few years' time, we'll be looking back and we'll see that Oregon's workers will have accumulated billions of dollars toward their retirement that would not otherwise exist. So today's report is required under the enabling legislation, but it serves another purpose. It gives us a chance to come together and talk with you, and also we had a pretty small marketing budget, so this is another way for us to spread the word about what's coming down the pike and to get Oregonians excited about their retirement plan. We also want all Oregonians to know that we're actively soliciting feedback to the draft rules for the plan. These have been published. We've got a public rulemaking hearing later this week on Thursday, and written comments will be accepted through December 23. Then we'll be looking very carefully at that feedback so that the final permanent rules do a very good job of reflecting an efficient, well-organized plan for Oregon. And more information is available at oregon.gov/retire. Let me jump forward. So some good news and some bad news. First, the good news, we're living longer. The bad news, our savings is a bit anemic. So as we talked about, a healthy 65-year-old is looking at 20 years on average in retirement, but probably not well prepared for it. Wrong arrow. All right. The Aspen Institute came to Oregon to help us present at the Oregon Savings Summit in June. It highlighted plans like these are going to be critical to help blunt a wave of poverty in retirement, but there are some other benefits too. We've been having roundtables with employers around the state, and they uniformly say they want to help their employees be more financially secure. Research also shows that when employees have less financial stress, their job performance, attendance, and job satisfaction all improve. A couple of things. Oftentimes, Oregon finds that it's a leader in this space, so it wasn't our intent to be first, but in fact, we are pioneering. There's a fairly bright spotlight on our activity, and we're working to make sure that we get it right. Let me share a few of the characteristics of the plan with you. So again, the board opted to go with a Roth IRA plan as a model. A Roth IRA has several advantages in this context. Savings go in after tax and accumulate without tax and are not taxed later. Importantly, savings can be accessed in an emergency without a penalty for any of the dollars that participants have saved in themselves. And the program itself combines the best features of both IRAs and 401ks in a very simple way. So it's amazing to think about. We talked about the fact that more than a million Oregonians don't have the ability to save at work. This is the breakdown here from the researchers from Boston College who worked with us in resurveying Oregon's working population. So a few things for you to be aware of. Workers without access to plans often share one or more of these characteristics. They are younger. They earn less. They probably or may work part-time. They have fewer years of formal education. They're more likely to be non-white. They're more likely to work for a small company. And they're more likely to work in the service and hospitality sector. But I will just mention that all of the other sectors are represented as well. Let's talk a little bit about the impact on employers and small businesses, which is very important. We're holding roundtables across the state and are answering sometimes dozens of inquiries daily, working with small businesses and their representatives. So we're also working with partner agencies to make sure they're helping us spread the word and help us gather feedback and advice. Why? So again, we have found that a lot of employers offer plans in Oregon, but more don't. It represents about two-thirds of our employer base, and we know that a large chunk of those, about 80%, have fewer than 10 employees. The other side of the equation is that about half of the people who don't have a plan actually work for a larger employer. So it's important to make sure that both are well considered and that the program be accessible and easy to use, both for small employers who will be affected in large numbers and large employers who employ a majority of the affected employees. The Treasurer's requirement is that this plan is simple to administer. So here's a little bit about how it will work. I'm going to click through these really fast. For employers, there'll be a minimal cost associated with entry into and facilitation of the program. Facilitation of the plan includes elements like introducing the ORSP to employees, providing data to automatically enroll employees, processing and remitting payroll deductions, and collecting opt-out decisions. So we've worked very hard to keep this absolutely as small and minimal as it possibly can be. This past week, the board has approved a company to be the plan service provider to the program. That company will manage the interface for customers, run the helpline, and be a very strong source of support for Oregon in launching and operating this new plan. So based on the draft rules, here's the division of what employees and employers will do. And again, we've placed a high priority on keeping it as simple as possible and keeping the paperwork to a minimum. So as we mentioned, employers are first confirming whether they do or don't offer a plan. If they don't offer a plan today, they'll be facilitating the retirement savings plan. And in doing that, walking through the steps that I described a few minutes ago. From an employee standpoint, and if you've ever belonged to a plan where you had to do paperwork in order to get in, this matters. So from an employee standpoint, you don't actually need to do anything to join the plan. You'll be automatically enrolled. But if you don't want to be in, it's really easy. You also don't have to be in. So there are choices that employees can make about saving more or less, choosing a different type of an investment, or as we mentioned, opting out of the program altogether. We engaged a wide variety of experts for financial and legal analysis and specifically did a financial feasibility study for the program. As Treasurer Wheeler mentioned, according to the detailed financial analysis, the plan is financially feasible in a number of different directions. So we looked primarily at two big categories of how long will it take to become cash flow positive and how long will it take to become net positive. So we're paying its own startup costs. Importantly, the plan is self-sustaining and works well under a wide variety of circumstances. So that includes higher and lower levels of participation and other important factors that make the program very resilient. By offering the plan service provider a longer-term contract, we're actually able to start the program by using a provider who will invest with us and in us early on and use the surpluses in later years to pay back that startup cost. Very important, I think, at this point in time in Oregon to have that type of program. New DOL safe harbors allow the plan to be considered a non-ERISA plan, so very important to employers. So that means we can help employees save while not imposing a fiduciary risk on employers. So that's absolutely a win-win. And with that, I would like to turn the conversation over to Joel Metlin for a brief introduction of how we've been working with employers and employees.
Yes. Thank you, Lisa, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Metlin, and I work for the Oregon State Treasury. So what we have going on right now is a lot of moving pieces to get us ready for that start date in July. And in that process, we want to make sure that we're actively engaging all of the folks that are going to be impacted by this plan. And that includes, you know, employers across the state, all the different sectors that Lisa discussed, and really starting to get the word out there and making sure that people not only know about it, but have a chance to be involved and to let us know what they think. And a big part of that right now is the rulemaking and setting the stage and being able to explain to people exactly what they're going to need to do, how they're going to do it, and when they need to do it. And making sure that they have a chance to tell us what will work and what won't so that we develop a program that actually does what it's intended to do. So we're in that process now, and along with that, we're doing a lot of outreach. Lisa mentioned the employer roundtables we've been holding, and it's really a chance for us to listen to employers. It's not necessarily about us presenting, here's what you're going to need to do. It's what sort of questions do you have? What information do you need? And what's going to impact your business? And how can we make it work for you and for your employees? We plan to do the same with employees over the next few weeks to give us a baseline of information as we're making these important decisions and we're deciding how can we communicate this plan and the information about it, the benefits, make sure that people understand it as we get closer to implementation. A lot of the questions that we have, some we have answers to, some we don't, and we're going to make sure that we have those answers. And now that we have a plan service provider picked, and now that we are starting to think more about how outreach will work, we're getting closer to being able to answer all those questions and have the information that people actually need on hand so that when they have to make a decision about this as an employer, do I facilitate this plan? Do I offer my own plan at this point? Or as an employee, do I participate? And if I do, what are my choices? You know, I can go for the automatic enrollment or these other options, and I need to be able to understand those as the decision comes forward. So the next steps really are we are soliciting interest from businesses about helping us not only design the plan but then be part of a pilot starting in July, so that we can have folks giving us constant feedback as we're preparing, then during implementation, testing to make sure that everything works before we do a larger rollout and really start trying to reach people on a statewide basis. So we're going to have folks there with us who are actually in the process as employers and employees participating in this on a small scale so that we know how it's going to work on a larger scale. And the phased-in implementation after the pilots will begin starting in early 2018. So as part of this process of reaching out to folks, We've also been engaging them in a larger discussion about financial literacy. The enabling legislation actually required the Oregon State Treasury to look into the matter and then to try to come up with a series of recommendations for how we could improve it, financial literacy across the state. Because it's not just a retirement problem we have. It's an issue of people not being able to make informed decisions because they don't necessarily have the tools and resources or skills readily available to them. So we've been having larger discussions with the financial literacy, the financial services industry, to try to figure out what's the role for us at Treasury as we implement this plan, because it's going to be a touch point with a lot of Oregonians. How can we engage people so that we are making the most of our program and its startup, as well as bring in partners to discuss how does that fit into the larger scheme of helping people improve their financial well-being. And the report includes the recommendations that we came up with after developing a work group, bringing in a bunch of stakeholders, having a series of discussions, and then working with our sister agencies and the governor's office to try to prioritize what we saw as the important ways to move the ball forward, to actually what could we do that would make a difference. And those are outlined in the reports, but what we essentially found is that Oregon has a great network and a lot of resources currently available. They're not necessarily coordinated as best as they could be to have the maximum impact. And so for us, we're going to look at ways that we as Treasury can better interact with our partners to improve financial literacy, but we're also looking for ways that the state as a whole can take action. And we will continue meeting after this to try to see if we can. It's not just something that we did for the report and then we're done on our end. We want to make sure that we're continuing to move forward, and we hope that you could help us do that and partner with us to look at ways that we can do that as a whole, as a state. With that, that's the end of our presentation, and we're very happy to take your questions about any of the things that we discussed.
Thank you. I just want to thank you, Treasurer Wheeler, and also Lisa, and everybody who put a lot of work into this. I think it's really a monumental step forward for Oregon. And I think we have time for one question, and since this is perhaps your last meeting
Certainly.
With this committee, we will allow you one question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. So I love this program. Mm-hmm. I love it. Very proud of the work you guys have done. It does, however, as we've always known, have kind of one soft underbelly, and that is the fact that it is opt-out instead of opt-in. Could be construed to, you know, run afoul of the voluntariness requirement of the IRA safe harbor under ERISA. Now, I know that we worked really hard to narrowly tailor it based on Department of Labor guidelines, such as they were. However, we're about to have a new Department of Labor, and that might change it. Now, it's not the end of the world. We could just, in worst case scenario, shift it to an opt-in instead of opt-out, and we'd be fine. But do we have any signs or indication from the incoming administration about what that means for states that are trying to do this?
I'd be happy to comment on that. So thank you for your question. I think it's a good one. Briefly, so the bill was originally written under the 1975 Safe Harbor. It was written with that in mind. Along the way, in it was August of this year, the Department of Labor wrote a broader Safe Harbor. That Safe Harbor is now effective, and we are able to use it. It provides, you know, even better clarity about how these plans fit in, and that they are not ERISA. They don't invoke an ERISA requirement on employers, and they're very clear about what employers can and cannot do. It's possible that a new administration could come in and really work hard to pull this back. I'm not seeing a lot of things that indicate that they want to. I also think that people actually want these programs to the extent that they want anything. I think people want more access to retirement. But it's an important question. We are keeping a close eye on it. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Again, thank you very much and for all your work on this. And I know members are aware of the report, and we have the ability to stay in touch with the Treasurer's office going forward. So I look forward to this rollout starting in July.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Thank you for everything you did.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck.
Up next, we have a presentation on fair pay in the workplace, and we're going to start with Representative Ann Leininger and Senator Dianne Rosenbaum. And this may be her last time presenting in the committee as well.
She'll be back. Well, thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38, Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk about the really important issue of pay equity. You may be aware that according to a National Women's Law Center study, women earn 80% on the dollar to the amount that men earn. And in 2015, the Pew Research did a study on median hourly wages, which showed that for every $21 that white men make a median hourly wage of $21, white women make a median hourly wage of $17. And for people of color, it gets even more extreme. African-American men, according to the study, make a median hourly wage of $15. Latino men, $14. African-American women, $13. And Latinas, $12 in median hourly wage. Now, I know that we all want families to be able to be self-sufficient through the hard work of the breadwinners and the families. And one of the issues that I think we probably all agree on as well is that it's important to make sure that people are compensated fairly for their work so that they can take care of their own families. Today we have a presentation from a number of people who are going to help frame up the issue of the fact that there's a problem we face still in our country, even though we've made a lot of progress on a lot of workplace fairness issues. That has to do with people being fairly compensated for work that is the same as other people doing that work. So what we're going to do today is frame up the problem and the need. And you are probably aware that around the country and in Oregon, there are conversations of how to address that need. But for this segment of conversation, we're going to help tee up what the need looks like and why we should care about it. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Senator Dianne Rosenbaum. But first, I want to note that we'll be hearing today from Family Forward Oregon, the representative of the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council, representative of American Association for University Women, and a representative of the Oregon Women's Foundation to help share information on this important issue. Thank you, and here is Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you very much, Representative Leininger, for that nice introduction, and good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dianne Rosenbaum. I am Rob Noce's state senator for the moment, and I'm very glad to appear before you today because it might be the last chance I get to actually testify as a senator in front of a committee on this side of the dais, so you don't have to all get choked up. But be nice to me. And I also want to say that I'm here today very pleased that the chair has called this hearing because I truly believe that fair pay matters to every Oregon family and that this is an issue that we should be able to unite around as we have historically in Oregon. It's an issue I've been working on certainly my whole 18 years in the legislature, but there are people in our state who have been working on it for a much longer time than I have. And I always like to start with the story of how Oregon got the first minimum wage law in the country, because there was a nun whose name was Sister Miriam Teresa, who went to work in the sweatshops in downtown Portland where women were working gluing labels on shoeboxes for a piece rate and not able to make any money because they were carrying hot pails of water, sticky labels on shoeboxes. Hands got sticky, water burned hands, and they were making just no money at all. So the sister decided that was not right. She came down here to the Capitol building at the time and got the very first minimum wage law in the entire nation passed in 1913. And it only applied to women at the time, but it became the model for the National Fair Labor Standards Act. So Sister Miriam Teresa, I think, started a long and proud tradition in Oregon of addressing the problems of the fact that we know we have two-thirds of families who either have a woman as their sole breadwinner, or certainly families today rely on two incomes to be able to put food on the table and a roof over their heads. And indeed, in addition to the minimum wage, there are many, many other things that we have done that are a lot to be proud of. In 2007, we passed House Bill 2007. That was a bill that Representative Jessica Vega Peterson and I were the co-sponsors of, that just represented the simple proposition that you couldn't be disciplined or fired for mentioning how much money you make to your coworker, because it seemed so simple, right? Like, if you didn't know how much you were making in relation to your coworkers, how would you even know if you were being underpaid for the same work? You will soon hear a lot of facts and figures about the size of the problem in Oregon, but I will just leave you with the fact that if we don't find a way to address this problem of unequal pay, we can't possibly have a prosperous state, the prosperous state that we all want to see, where all of our kids and all of our families in rural areas, in metro areas, are able to succeed. And so I'm very delighted to be able to kick off this hearing today. I expect that Sister Miriam Teresa is looking down on us from somewhere. She's no longer with us. I expect to be looking down on you as you are moving forward on this issue, hopefully not from heaven. I expect to be in a gallery in the future so that I can continue this very good work. I'm proud of what you are embarking on, and when we come to Equal Pay Day in approximately April or Tax Day of 2017, I'm hoping that we have made even more progress. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both, and we'll move on to the presentation, and committee will hold our questions till the end so we can get through this agenda. Up next, Andrea Peluso and Gadelia Contreras and Tracy Rossi and Trish Garner. Didn't know all four wanted to get up together, so. Good morning and welcome. If you would introduce yourself before you give your comments, thank you.
Hello, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk with you today about this important issue. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon. First, I wanted to note that I brought copies for you of a report entitled Pay Inequality in Oregon. This was produced by the Oregon Council on Civil Rights and released in 2014, commissioned by the Bureau of Labor. We believe this report gives really good background on the problem of pay inequality in Oregon. It provides a good snapshot of the data and some good recommendations for how to close gender-based pay inequality in our state. These recommendations appear in four categories: around outreach and public awareness, educational and occupational programs, employer incentives and workplace best practices, and also through legislation and enforcement. So first, I want to say there are some legal protections, as we've heard, that exist under Oregon's Equal Pay Act, which states that there should be no difference in pay based on sex for the same work. Additional protections against discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, and marital status and age were extended under the Fair Employment Practices Act and in the Unlawful Discrimination in Employment Act. You'll see that despite these legal protections, pay inequity continues to persist. On page 10 of this report, you'll see an important figure that demonstrates pay inequality for men and women in a few different racial categories. There are a few things to note here. One, obviously, pay inequities exist among men by race. And two, women of color who are experiencing discrimination by both race and sex see the greatest pay disparities of all groups. These additional wage inequalities are experienced by any population of women who face additional discrimination as a result of intersecting identities, whether that be women of color or queer and trans women. Another key point in this report concerns mothers. Motherhood is a predictor of poverty in old age in this country. Single motherhood is a predictor of poverty at any age. Most Oregon children live in poverty because their mothers live in poverty. And mothers' wages matter increasingly. Nearly two-thirds of mothers are now breadwinners or co-breadwinners for their families. I think Trish from American Association of University Women will say more about the compounding effects of pay inequality through a woman's lifetime, because those gaps add up over the course of her lifetime. But the reality is that for women entering the workforce, the wage gap is the lowest that it will be throughout a woman's life. And mothers, with each experience of adding a child to their family, time out of the workforce to care for that child, add additional gaps throughout their working lives. They also experience increased discrimination in the workforce as a result of their real or perceived family caregiving responsibilities. This motherhood penalty means that Oregon mothers, on average, are earning just 73 cents of what fathers earn. That's why it's important to understand the broader problems that are driving pay inequality. The first and our kind of most commonly held view is that this is a result of difference in pay based on the same job. And that happens, even though, as noted, we have some laws that are intended to protect against this. We believe we need more outreach and enforcement to ensure that these laws are followed and that employees understand their rights under existing laws. Additionally, we know that people often don't know what their colleagues are making, except in the public sector, where actually wage gaps are narrower than they are in the private sector. That is a result of increased transparency about wages and additional categorization of jobs and pay that are tied to qualifications. Second, we know that there's a greater deal of gender-based pay disparity across occupations. Even in occupations that require a similar level of training and education and risk, those working in traditionally women-dominated fields are likely to be paid significantly less than those working in traditionally male-dominated fields, even for comparable work. So many have suggested, and I think we've moved the needle on improving access for women to more STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, and also investing in women entrepreneurs and small business owners who are less likely to be able to access capital through traditional means. These are important solutions. However, we also feel it's important to reflect on the fact that we need to increase wages and benefits in traditionally women-dominated fields. The answer is not entirely moving all women into STEM. It's also valuing the very important work that women are doing, especially in caregiving fields. And then finally, another factor in the pay inequality discussion is that we need to build structures around work that support women in staying attached to the labor market. Structures like paid leave, affordable childcare, flexibility, its opposite, scheduling predictability, and other family care supports. Having these support structures around jobs ensures that families can have access to work and that women can compete on an equal playing field for pay, promotions, and raises. Currently, women, especially those who have family caregiving responsibilities, are operating in work environments that were not designed for them. We have not updated the workplace or the structures of support around workplaces that accommodate those who need to both care for and provide for a family. And the last thing I'll note is that gender and race-based wage gaps, combined with the greater debt load of those who faced increased barriers to fair pay and more economic insecurity, adds up over the course of one's lifetime in other ways. While women in Oregon on average earn just 79 cents compared to their male counterparts, and while Black women earn just 60 cents compared to white men, Native women 59 cents, Latinas earn 55 cents as compared to white men. The greater disparity that we see is that accumulating over the course of a lifetime and over the course of generation in terms of wealth gaps. Mariko Chang, a researcher and author of the book Shortchanged, notes that white women have 46 cents in wealth compared to the average dollar held by white men. For Asian women, they have 53 cents of wealth compared to the dollar held by Asian men. For black women, it's 42 cents. For Hispanic women, it's they have a median wealth of zero compared to every dollar held by Hispanic men. Put another way, more than half of single Hispanic women have no wealth at all. Mothers have 22 cents of wealth compared to every dollar held by fathers. These gaps are a product of wage disparities and higher levels of income insecurity throughout one's lifetime, but also reflect intergenerational wealth disparities that result from differential access to economic opportunity by people of color, and especially women of color over generations. These compounding factors mean that black women have a median wealth of $200, and Hispanic women just $100, or less than a penny of wealth for every dollar of wealth owned by single white men. Gender-based wage disparities and wealth gaps have profound impacts on Oregon's families. Gone are the times that most families rely on just a single income by a male breadwinner. Women's wages matter to families. When they're paid less, it matters. It has implications. When women are economically secure in terms of both wages and wealth, so are their children. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Gudelia Contreras Flores. I work in the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council, and thank you for letting me give you two small histories of what happened when you work as a woman or Latina in the community of the Astoria, Oregon. People who is working in the hotel as a housekeeping, if you are a female, you're going to have 20 rooms or 17 rooms to clean in the same amount of time as a white, a lady working as a housekeeping. It's a huge difference when you work as a housekeeping. I never worked as a housekeeping, but it's a really hard job. I don't want to do that. But if you are a Latino or if you are a woman, compared to the white, it's the same kind of pay, it's the same kind of job, but you just have to do sometimes double or what a white person do it. Working in the Canaries, I used to be a Canary worker, and it's a really hard work. We are talking about working 16 hours a day sometimes. But if you are Latino, if you are female, they're going to ask you to do double the job. They don't care if you, as female, you have to have the special days. Sometimes that's one of the reasons they had to let you go, because they don't want you to have the time to use it, like just to go to the bathroom. Just something as simple like that. You know, as a female, we had a special need every month. Everybody know that. And sometimes the bus is like, why are you going to the bathroom too many times? And if you are Latino, or if you are a mother, there are like, she's pregnant. She's going to need to go to the doctor more often. So maybe don't hire her. But things like that. Sometimes people don't really see until you are in that position. If you are trying to do something better than you like, sometimes you get fired for that too. That happened to me. They didn't fire me. I quit. But because I want to go back to school, I'm going to ask for more money because I'm going to have more education. They say, we need somebody who can stay here with us longer. So that is what happened in the fish canneries and the hotels in the Astoria area. And I think it's not fair just to be a female or to try to get more education. They don't give you the opportunity to do better than that. And I can give you like too many histories of that, too many examples, but I know we don't have the time here. So this is only two examples I give it to you, like how the females that work in the Canaries, just to be females and to be Latinas, they have to work double. Or just to be a Latinas and work in the fish canneries or in the hotels, they have to work the same hard job, but without more breaks or without more salary. It's just not fair. I think if you can change that, that will be good for everybody in the community. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Garner. I'm the State Public Policy Chair of AUW Oregon. That's American Association of University Women. We've been working to advance equity among girls and women since 1881. I wanted to talk to you today about fair pay for families and the fact that comparable work should result in the same wage. And I'm going to start with a personal example, if that's okay. Several years ago, I worked as a criminal defense attorney. I have served as an assistant United States attorney in both Illinois and North Carolina, but my legal career was primarily as a criminal defense attorney. And I remember only too well, I represented an individual in a federal trial. There had been years of pretrial investigations and, background work. The trial lasted over a week, and as a court-appointed attorney, I submitted my bill, as everyone did. But the judge reduced it by half, saying, well, after all, my husband was a doctor. You know, I thought that this kind of attitude was antiquated. Yes, ouch. Mm-hmm. And what can you say to a federal district court judge?
I have a few.
Except, thank you, Your Honor.
but I'm not an attorney.
Yes. I thought that this kind of attitude was antiquated, but just recently I was talking to one of our members, and she's a woman with a PhD in chemistry. She's working as an engineer in a very well-known high-tech firm. And as we all know, high-tech firms are supposed to be built on the concept of a meritocracy. However, that is not how it really worked with respect to women. This woman, who was frequently called a girl engineer, when her male counterpart and she were seeking a promotion and raise, she was told, well, you know, Josh needed it more because his wife just had a baby. And it was better for her marriage if her husband made more money than she. This is recent. This is a recent example, and it is unfortunately not a singular example. Gender discrimination in compensation begins early and indeed lasts a lifetime. Women graduate from college with a wage gap. 1 year out of college, women working full-time were paid just 82% of what their male peers were. Even after statistically controlling for hours, occupation, college major, employment sector, and other factors normally associated with pay, that disparity continued. As we also know, as women enter and take over a, or perhaps not take over, but as they enter a male-dominated field, the pay in that field goes down. You can't educate your way out of compensation disparity, and interestingly enough, in fact, it worsens. In 2014, the typical Oregonian woman with a graduate or professional degree earned 8.4% less than the typical Oregon man with just a bachelor's degree. Also, interestingly enough, women in Oregon in two highest paying occupations suffer from the same compensation disparity. In 2014, those in the health diagnosing and treating field, women earned 66 cents for every dollar earned by a man in 2014. In legal occupations, 64 cents on the male dollar. This disparity gets locked in, as I'm sure the mathematicians and others among you will know, as the years pass. And often women discover only at retirement that they have been the victim of wage discrimination for year after year after year. And that obviously has an incredibly significant impact on themselves and their families. But of course, it's too late by then. That compounding just is the way it is. My question today is, how can we expect girls to take and want and desire to work in good jobs if the odds are stacked against them? How can we tell young women that they must face this climate to pursue leadership roles? I hope to have a positive answer from you as we proceed, and that comparable work should receive the same wage. And I thank you so much for your attention. It's been a real honor.
Good morning. Thank you so much, and Representative Holvey, and to the members of the committee for inviting us this morning for your testimony. I'm speaking as a board member from the Women's Foundation of Oregon. I'm also an executive director of a nonprofit organization that works with economically vulnerable women, who are primarily women of color, and women, by the way. It's open to everyone.
And give us your name, too.
Oh, thank you. That's important. Tracy Rossi. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the Women's Foundation Counter-In Report. And I think all of you heard a little bit from Emily Evans back in September about the research that was done by the foundation. And in that report, it was revealed the startling inequities faced by the women and girls in Oregon, and many of them, unfortunately, are the worst in the nation. The wage gap in particular shows that women in every single Oregon county, that is all 36 counties, every single one of them face a substantial wage gap. And that's very significant. The Women's Foundation hosted a 14-stop listening tour and spoke with over 1,000 women across 3,000 miles. And in every single community, again, we heard so much concern, deep concern about the unfair pay and wage gap. We know that fair pay matters to every Oregon family. In my organization, we see this every day, the unfair consequences of what happens over time. Women come into our office and they're unbanked or underbanked, which means they aren't using the mainstream financial sector system, and they don't have savings. And 84% of the women that we serve are single moms. And so not only is that wage gap a significant issue, it becomes a wealth gap over time, as we've heard all over and over again this morning. The children are growing up in poverty, and the effects of compounding wage gap is going to impact their families for the next generation. I urge this committee to take action on fair pay and on each of you to consider the 8th that can't wait. Again, you heard in September, and we will have some more information forthcoming in some discussions this spring. Each of your offices have been given a copy of the report, and the foundation is hosting a series of these discussions, and we do hope that you'll join us and hear more about that. We also will be releasing a report that shows what has worked in other states, and that'll come out in January, and we urge you to read that report as well. As a concrete next step, read the reports, attend the discussions, and we're eager to be a resource for all of you. We do want to be progressive in Oregon. We do want to solve this problem, and we feel like if we work together, we can do that. Thanks again for your invitation to come this morning to testify, and I guess if you have any questions.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Representative Doherty.
Okay, one quick question. Have there been comparisons of people who are in union jobs with union contracts? Because I've always made the same as a man just because I've always had a union job.
Yes, absolutely. And we see lower pay disparities in among represented employees than non-represented employees. Happy to provide that
data. Not lower pay, but lower disparities.
Less disparity. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that was mentioned was enforcement, and then I didn't hear much about enforcement. So we already have laws on the books that say equal pay. What will enforcement look like, or how will it be different, you know, with this agenda?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges with many of our labor laws is that the trigger to enforcement is an employee complaint. And generally what we see is that employees don't know what the existing laws are. And they don't know what their rights are under existing laws. So one recommendation would be to really spend some time and energy making sure that employees have a sense of what their existing rights are, know how to trigger an enforcement complaint, and that we have adequate resources to follow up on those complaints.
Yeah, follow up. So one of the things that I heard, I think, was that from some of the examples was, well, your husband's a doctor, so you don't have to do this, or some other excuse in the workplace. As an employer, you have a lot of different employees that have different personalities and different character qualities. And so years ago, we started hiring character first. I mean, we wanted to know what the employee, who they were, rather than what they knew or what they could do, and then find out afterwards. Or you can always train someone with character. And typically, you know, in the workplace, they will help their fellows, workers, they want to do good work, they take pride in the work. See, every employee has a different makeup. And what I see here is, and I understand this, and I'm not, first of all, we have women and men in our workplace, but they're not paid according to whether they're a male or a female. It's what they produce, how they work, and the character of the person and the position that they have. And so I'm just trying to figure out on an enforcement level how you drill down and get down to the fact that they're being paid less because they're a woman or a minority rather than a white male. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and there are existing enforcement protocols that go through that process of inquiry and investigation and that exist now and that function well when they're utilized. And I would say there are also a number of employer best practices that I think it would be useful to have more employers know and understand so they can be sure that people are being appropriately compensated for the work they're being asked to do and in regard to sort of how their similarly situated colleagues are being compensated, and that we're putting systems in place that reduce the potential for bias in a workplace.
Chair Holvey, I wonder if I might speak briefly. Thank you. I think there are two points that Representative Pareto, you raised. One relates to, well, gosh, how can you different people have different experiences and bring different experiences. I think the point is that if you're doing comparable work, then you should be paid the same wage. Obviously, there are issues like seniority, length of experience. Obviously, if there's a job that's based on quantity or quality of production, piecework kind of things. I think that there are parameters that can seek to distinguish some aspects of employment. But particularly when you see the vast disparities that we've been testifying to, I think it's important to make a statement. There should be no discrimination in compensation based on gender. The other issue with respect to enforcement, there are laws here on the books, but they're with respect to discrimination on the basis of sex, but they're in the wages and hours section. And so an employee has to go through the Bureau of Labor and Industries procedure. I believe there's a one-year statute of limitations. There are a number of limitations that, as I understand it, no one has ever pursued an enforcement action under that section. There's obviously a broad law that says that there should be no discrimination on the basis of sex, religion, race, national origin, etc. But there's nothing specifically that raises women to the level of protection other than that generic phrase. And what I believe would be appropriate is to have a separate statute, not in the wages and hours section, but perhaps under the civil rights section is 259A, if I'm remembering that correctly. Please don't hold me to that. But that would say that women who do comparable work, subject to the exceptions such as I think you were noting, should be paid the same. So I think that hopefully addresses your concerns. We need a separate statute.
Can I follow up with that? Just real short.
Okay.
So is this primarily directed towards salaried employees rather than hourly?
It's directed towards both.
Okay.
So just for clarity, the disparity figures that you were using is based on the same amount of time that a woman would be working, as you're comparing hours to hours.
Correct.
Being the same.
As statistically, and I never am able to say that word well, as statistically perfect as statistics can be. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? I appreciate your efforts and bringing this back before our committee. I think the figures certainly point to some issues, certainly, and obviously our discrimination laws haven't been able to address that, I'm assuming. That may be a generalization I shouldn't make, but that's certainly what it seems like. So thank you very much for your time this morning. I appreciate your presentation. Up next, we're going to have a preview from Department of Consumer and Business Services on some legislative concepts that they'll be bringing forward. I see Patrick Allen, the director, is stepping up. I don't know if there's anyone to join him. It looks like there are some coming up to help you out here.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined today by Lou Savage, who's the administrator of our Workers' Compensation Division, and Jennifer Flood, who is the state's ombudsperson for injured workers. The department's mission, as you know, is to serve and protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state, and we're coming to the 17th session with a fairly robust legislative package, really on both those fronts of consumer protection and worker protection. You have two documents in OLIS. One is a summary of the consumer protection and financial-oriented concepts that we're bringing. We're not planning on spending time today talking about those. Second document that you have that's the focus of our presentation today is on the concepts that we have that are around worker protection, which takes two forms, and we're going to do a little bit of shuttling ourselves here at the table around the workers' compensation system and worker protection through Oregon OSHA. If you've been through our budget presentations over probably the last decade, you've heard us talk about really looking at worker safety as a complete system that starts with preventing workplace injuries, accidents, and illness, and moves through to taking care of workers when those kinds of issues occur through the workers' compensation system. We have today, through a lot of hard work by a lot of people over a long period of time, without hesitation say is one of the strongest worker compensation systems in the country. And that's a far cry from where we were in the late 80s when we had one of the worst workers' compensation systems in the country today. We have the seventh lowest workers' compensation rates in America. And if you've probably followed some news over the last couple of years that have focused on states that have driven down their workers' compensation rates essentially on the backs of benefits to workers, and we have fundamentally not done that in Oregon. We've been able to improve worker benefits while driving down costs for employers through the programs and efforts that we have, and what we're bringing to the session in 17, we think, are continued improvements along that track of trying to make sure that the system delivers better outcomes for the people who are paying the bills and the people who benefit from this, from not being injured on the workplace, but then being taken care of when they are. And so I'm going to turn the presentation over to Lou and then Jennifer to talk about the workers' compensation side of the concepts that we're bringing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. As Pat said, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division. We have three concepts we'd like to talk to you about today. The first involves, and I should mention that the governor has approved the filing of these concepts for this coming legislative session. The first concept involves medical arbiter panels. This is a point in the system where if a claim is closed by an insurer, the extent of the permanent disability is determined, and the worker or the insurer can file a request for review by the division. And if there's objection to findings, a claim is referred to a medical arbiter for review. We actually have a panel that the statute requires, a panel of three arbiters. This has actually been an ongoing challenge for us because of medical specialties, geographic challenges for getting three arbiters together, scheduling, and inconvenience for the worker. So what we're proposing is to allow the department to, by rule, determine whether three or two arbiters are appropriate. This could save some costs, save some problems with travel, and make the system work more efficiently. The benefit to that is it's actually a reduction in insurer costs up to $278,000 a year. Not a big ticket item, but certainly helps to reduce the costs for insurers and make the system work more efficiently. So that's the first concept. The second involves self-insurance and continuing to streamline the regulatory process. The as you know, employers can decide to either get insurance through a company or be self-insured. In 2014, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 1558, and that was enacted to address an urgent situation. It was relating to a default of several self-insured groups to make sure the workers were getting benefits timely. We have found that we needed to make a couple of fixes to that. One of the major points of Senate Bill 1558 allowed the DCBS director to immediately assign a claims processor and not go through the state procurement process. And of course, this was because we wanted to make sure that workers got their benefits quickly. So this was for self-insured employer groups that were in default or decertified, so we could immediately get someone in the claims processing process to make sure that those claims were paid. The problem was that the language omitted defaulted or decertified self-insured employers as opposed to self-insured employer groups. So this legislative concept would fix that problem. The second piece that we found was is relating to damages against third parties. Often a situation will come up where a third party is involved in the injury of a worker, for example, with an auto accident. If a self-insured is decertified or defaulted, the department pays the benefits, and it comes out of public funds, and it's either the worker benefit fund, self-insured employer adjustment reserve, or the self-insured employer group adjustment reserve. Currently, the way the law is written, even though the department is paying those benefits, when there's a recovery, the recovery goes to the defaulted employer. And not back to the department to recoup the public funds. So the second part of this concept would just really go to make sure that the state is made whole when public funds are expended for an injured worker. There's an amendment that we're going to be proposing, which is not in the original legislation, and it involves a processing agent who, again, is processing the claim. and may be involved in a dispute with a worker, where you know there's an issue about the claim, and the problem has come up periodically where the claims processor needs to hire a lawyer. The proposed amendment that we have would allow the claims processor to hire an independent counsel as opposed to relying on the Department of Justice. We're concerned that the potential for a conflict of interest would occur because, in fact, the state is still paying the benefits even though there's a claim processor. So the prospect of the Department of Justice representing both the claims processor and the state gives us cause for some concern. So we are going to be proposing an amendment to address that problem. The last concept, which we believe is very important, is the benefit improvement concept. We have taken a look at the benefit structure for injured workers, and we've identified two categories of benefits where we think there should be an improvement. One is for permanently totally disabled workers, and these are the folks who are not going back to work. They've suffered a serious injury, and they are not going back to their job. The current structure has a minimum benefit of 90% of the worker's wages or $50 a week, whichever is less. And if you take a look at those numbers, that is a very low benefit scale. The maximum is 66 2/3 of the wages, subject to 100% of the state average weekly wage. Our proposal is to increase the minimum for these permanently total disabled workers to 33% of the state average weekly wage, and to increase the maximum to 133% of the state average weekly wage, but to retain the basis of the benefit at 66 2/3 of the worker's wage. So again, for both the minimum and the maximum, we would propose a bump for that. Now, the other category we looked at was permanent partial disability. And again, we have found that those folks who suffer an impairment, a partial impairment, and return to work are not fully recovering their economic loss. And so what we are proposing for these folks is to increase the impairment benefit to 133% of the state average weekly wage. Happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we actually turn to Jennifer and then take questions as a
okay. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Flood, Ombudsman for Injured Workers with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you again for asking us here today to talk about these concepts. Legislative Concept 698 streamlines survivor benefits for children of workers who have died as a result of an on-the-job injury or occupational disease. Through the efforts of many folks, fortunately, fatalities on the job are rare. But to those families who are forced to deal with such a loss, the effects could be devastating. This LC primarily focuses on three benefit areas. First, the LC sets the standard end of eligibility date to 19 years of age for all children of the deceased worker. Our current statute sets that standard to end at the age of 18 or 19, and it's determined by the age of the child when they leave high school. So some kids get it till 18, other kids get it till 19. A standard benefit really should end, I believe, for all children at the same time. The second concept in this LC is to create one monthly benefit for all children of the deceased workers. Currently, there are two levels, and that's that's determined on the marital status and the living situation of the worker prior to their death. Creating one level will treat all children of the deceased worker the same, and it will remove the determination and judgment of the worker's marital choice and living situation. And then the final area is the structure of the monthly benefits for a child that's attending higher education. The concept creates a structure that provides a flexible benefit for 48 months while the child is attending higher education. The current statute does provide monthly benefits for higher education, but the structure is archaic and rigid, causing unpredictable eligibility and potentially leaving children without the ability to pursue education in college or in trade school. I believe the proposed changes will provide predictable, streamlined delivery of these benefits to the children of these workers who left for work but unfortunately did not return home. That's what I got.
So before I ask Michael Wood to join us to talk about worker safety concepts, see if there are questions that you might have on the workers' compensation portion of what we're talking about for 17.
Certainly. I appreciate the presentation and look forward to discussing these legislative concepts going forward. Sounds like you've got some well-thought-out concepts. And I'm sure it may be of interest to some whether or not MLAC's reviewed these concepts yet.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, MLAC has seen a first cut of the concept and will be reviewing them within the next month.
Great. So they may have a decision whether they support or oppose or take no position before session starts, hopefully.
We anticipate approval by MLAC, but of course if MLAC has concerns, we would fully address those before we bring anything.
And I apologize for using acronyms, the Management Labor Advisory Committee, I believe it's called.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Other questions?
If not, then I'd like to ask Michael Wood, the Administrator of Oregon OSHA.
I have one question about the arbiter.
Sure.
I was looking to see if anybody else had questions. I don't see any. Are there qualifications for these arbiters that are set out in statute? I'm just thinking about their independence and, you know, what kind of background do you require for arbiters?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, there are requirements for arbiters. We have standards.
Good. I'm glad you do. maybe you could share those with me at a later time.
I could provide those to the committee, certainly. Yeah. I don't know the answer to whether they're in statute or whether they're in administrative rule, but they're in one or the other.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate that.
Then I'd like to ask Michael Wood to join me. We've just talked about the worker compensation system, the system that takes care of people when something happens on the job. Primary prevention is the other half of the equation. We work hard to with a voluntary consultation program as well as risk-based targeted inspections and enforcement actions to try to assure that workers are safe on the job to begin with. And we've got a couple of concepts in that space. I'll turn it over to Michael.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us here today. For the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we normally just refer to as Oregon OSHA. We have three concepts today that cover three seemingly disparate topics, although they do actually have a constant theme. In all three cases, they relate to numbers, dollar figures that are spelled out in statute that actually have become somewhat out of date over time, and so we're looking to address those issues. The first concept, LC 700, would align Oregon OSHA's penalty authority with federal penalty authority. Last year, Congress, in the budget process, revised the penalty authority under the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act. And what they did was they actually eliminated an exemption to an inflation adjustment that they had passed years previously. So there was a 1996 law that made federal penalties adjust for the Consumer Price Index. Federal OSHA's penalties were exempt from that law. What they did last year was remove that exemption and apply that removal retroactively. So that resulted in a one-time change in the penalty authority, in the penalty maximum of almost 80%. And that, as you can imagine, resulted in a fairly strong reaction as folks thought about an 80% increase in penalties. I do want to emphasize that it's an 80% increase, or a nearly 80% increase, in the penalty maximum. It doesn't actually change all penalties. And in fact, here in Oregon, presuming that we adopt it as we need to for reasons that I'll describe in a moment, I would anticipate that it would affect the top end of the penalties, but would have very little impact on the bottom. What I would expect is that it would basically leave the floor in place and move the ceiling up so that those where we already issue our highest penalties would go up, but it certainly wouldn't have an impact across the board. The reason that we need to adopt the change in penalties is that we are required under federal law to have penalty authority comparable to federal OSHA in order to maintain the approval for our program. So this is an issue that we simply need to adjust in order to maintain the continuing ability under the federal act to operate Oregon OSHA. Under the existing penalties, where we have the same penalty authority as federal OSHA, we actually assess the lowest penalties in the country on an average basis. Out of the 50 states in the country, Oregon OSHA assesses the 50th highest penalties. Now, that's in tandem with the fact that you're actually more likely to be inspected in this state than you are in others. We've relied on relatively high-frequency enforcement activity and relatively modest penalties for a number of years, and as you heard in Pat's introduction, that's worked well for the state, and we don't see a reason to change that basic approach. The details of how we'd apply the penalties would be spelled out in rulemaking. What we need to do is address the penalty authority issue so that we can move forward with that rulemaking. But there's another complicating twist, and that is that Congress also adjusted the penalty authority for federal OSHA moving forward, because it will adjust every year as the consumer price index changes. So this concept would seek the ability for us to make that adjustment as well, so that we're not coming back to make small changes in the penalty maximum in the statute every year before the legislature. So that's basically that concept in a nutshell. The second concept relates to the Worker Memorial Scholarship. The Worker Memorial Scholarship Fund provides scholarships to the dependents of workers who were killed or suffered permanent total disability on the job in Oregon. And those scholarships are paid out of penalty dollars that have been set aside and basically created a principal fund of $250,000. And the scholarships are paid out of the earnings from that principal. And that principal hasn't been increased for a number of years. There actually was a proposal that would have increased it to $1 million a number of years ago, heard in this committee. I believe it passed out of the committee, but ended up not moving beyond that. Something that we're now putting forward as a request proposal to allow us to increase it to $1 million. We issue the scholarships now. Right now, the typical scholarship is about $1,000. That's meaningful, but when you look at the cost of college now, it's not material. It's not really going to make the difference about whether or not a student is able to attend college. And in some cases, we'd like to be able to really provide folks who have suffered, frankly, a grievous loss over the course of typically their childhood, to be able to pursue college in situations where they wouldn't be able to otherwise, and increasing the principal and therefore increasing money available would enable us to do that. The third concept also adjusts a financial figure, and it is an existing provision in the law that requires that construction sites currently with $1 million or more in total project cost provide flush toilets and warm water wash basins. We are proposing that be increased to $1.75 million. Basically, that's the inflation adjustment since the last time it was changed. And we're actually asking that that we also be given rulemaking authority so that we can keep that in pace in the future. As I said, those are all concepts that basically are about adjusting for inflation figures that are written into the statute now. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why do we have a federal OSHA and a state OSHA?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, within our jurisdiction, we actually don't. The state OSHA program is the only one that enforces within our jurisdiction. Under the federal law, all state and local enforcement of occupational safety and health is actually preempted. And then states have the opportunity to take it back and control our own destiny. And when we do that under an approved state program, federal OSHA steps out. Okay. So it's actually different from a number of other frameworks, wage and hour, environmental regulation, where you actually have both state and federal regulators functioning in tandem. In occupational safety and health, part of the deal of doing it ourselves and submitting ourselves to federal oversight is that federal regulators do not enforce within Oregon OSHA's jurisdiction.
Short answer is you want to call Salem and not Seattle when you have a concern.
I like that.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the penalty side of the situation, the federal government dictates to you that you have to up these penalties according to their rules. Is it a rule or is it congressional bill that passed?
It was a bill that Congress, Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel, it was a bill that Congress passed as part of the one of the budget reconciliations that they went through last year.
So, follow up. So, in other words, we do a good job with what we're doing now, but it's not good enough according to the eyes of the federal government?
Well, I'd invite Michael to add to this, but I would say they, for budgetary reasons, made changes to structure, which then played itself out in laws that require our structure to mimic it. The more important thing from my standpoint is our approach to using penalty authority, regardless of what the range of it is not financially driven. It's driven in terms of how do we get people to comply? How do we achieve safe workplaces? I very, very frequently see penalties go by that are in the low hundreds of dollars for workplace safety violations, because we're not out there trying to make a bunch of money to support programs. We're out there trying to make sure people understand that something is a serious issue and needs to be dealt with. And for most small businesses, a little bit of financial ding helps do that, and it doesn't need to be tens of thousands of dollars in those kinds of cases. There are egregious cases where we really do need significant penalty authority, and they are typically places where we have repeat willful, intentional violations of worker safety law, where frankly we can point to cases where you get a pretty good sense that the employer was just pricing noncompliance into the work that they were doing. And in that kind of a circumstance, the ability to tip the scales a little bit harder is useful. But that's very, very rare in our administration of workplace safety law. Michael, anything you want to add?
Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel, this time I'll give the short answer. Federal OSHA penalties run between 10 and 20 times higher than ours for the same violation. That will not change.
Just to close then, if I can, we're really proud of this worker protection system that we have in Oregon, and I think sometimes you probably don't hear a lot about it because it doesn't generate bad news or outrage or the kinds of things that generate a lot of coverage, but this is an example of a system working together with employers and workers that we think is well calibrated. It really focuses on preventing problems in the workplace, keeping people safe to begin with, and then taking care of them. Over the last 20 years, we've been able to drive the cost of that system down. This year alone, the pure premium rate will be dropping by 6.6%. And over time, those decreases in employer costs have allowed us to continue to maintain and improve worker benefits so that getting hurt on the job doesn't mean that you suffer an economic penalty for the rest of your life, or that we can try to reduce that penalty that you suffer from. We think this is a very successful system. You've had a huge role together with the Management Labor Advisory Committee and all of our stakeholders in helping maintain the balance in that system, and we'll bring you some more ideas this session to help improve that. Be happy to answer any general questions you've got.
Thank you. I would be interested in seeing some data about the penalties, whether they're you know, you say they're quite a bit lower than the federal penalties. I've also get frustrated because I hear of things where the penalty doesn't change the behavior. I know there was a project in Eugene a couple of years back, the Capstone Project, that was on in the newspaper repeatedly for OSHA safety violations, and it seemed like the penalties didn't change their behavior at all. And at least that's what the newspapers were reporting. And so I just kind of wonder if we could see some statistics about, you know, the complaints that are filed, how often there's a violation found, and what the penalties are on those, and whether, you know, and what the difference is when it's a repeat violation. Those would be useful for us to when we start thinking about these concepts.
Yeah, I think we'd be happy to bring you some data generally, and then I think we can probably find some things in the public record that are illustrative examples of the different kinds of circumstances.
Yeah, it'd certainly be helpful to understand. And not to bring up current topics too much, but I've been getting some emails from folks about rulemaking about pesticide exposures that you're currently going through, and some real concern about not following the recommended rules from the EPA and looking at an alternative exposure, I guess, standard. And there's being referred to as the shelter in place standard, as opposed, you know, for workers, that you just, you know, shelter and wait for the pesticides to go over you, I guess. So I've been getting a lot of concern about that. So, you know, I'd like to get some follow-up on why this alternative is being proposed as opposed to the federal standard.
Chair Holvey, we can certainly provide some follow-up and some additional discussion. Just for clarification, it is not about sheltering in place when you're in a location where the pesticides are being applied. It's when you're in an adjacent location where the pesticides are not applied. And under current rules, there's actually no provision related to that. The question is what additional measure of safety to provide in those areas. It's a new provision in the EPA rule, and under our proposed rule, we are looking at that alternative. We can certainly arrange to have further conversation about it.
Yeah, that would be great if so I know how to respond to these questions. That would be helpful. Are there any other? Representative Esquivel.
One last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you still, example, I have a business, every one of us up here has a business. Are you still charging us by the frequency and the criticalness of the injury like you used to? Example, I worked in a place that was just awful with people, hurting people, and I think we were paying $65 per 100, which is astronomical.
Yes, Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel, yes. We, of course, don't actually provide the insurance. That's provided by insurance carriers, a variety of them, Safe being the best known and the largest. We set the pure premium rate, which is sort of the keystone rate that insurers then use to set their rates. That pure premium rate is driven by the overall risk in the marketplace. But then, yes, each individual insurer modifies that rate both to reflect its own expenses, but also your experience as an employer. And so riskier employers that have a worse claims rate certainly do pay higher rates than safer businesses. And then the insurers, Safe most notably, have extensive programming to work with employers to improve those safety records to be able to improve those premium rates.
Representative Barreto.
Well, I just have to say we had, there's two sides. There's the safety people that come in and do the investigations, which I think we called up and said, hey, come and check us out before we get checked out by the fine writers, you know. And so we did that, and it worked out very well. I mean, they came in and told us everything that we were doing wrong. I mean, most of it was just cleanup stuff. It wasn't major, but then when the other side, the enforcement side, did come in, you know, I have to say we have someone over in Eastern Oregon who's been there for a while, very nice guy, comes in, but not afraid to write you a fine, but very helpful, too, even on the penalty side. So We've been real happy with working with SAVE. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions. Thank you so much for giving us a preview of some of your concepts, and we look forward to further discussions on them.
See you next year.
You're hoping I don't see you this year. I guess I'm taking that. You have a good holiday anyway.
You also.
Committee, that I believe was our last agenda item. Was it not? That's it.
This is luxurious.
So we're done a few minutes early. I want to thank you for being here today, and also want to recognize that
I'm surprised
my vice chair, Representative Barton, will not be back in this committee, so we can, you know, celebrate his departure and his great work on this committee.
I'll be the first to celebrate with you, Mr. Chair. There you are.
With that, but seriously, thank you for serving on the committee and serving the state of Oregon and the legislature, and good luck with your new adventures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Family and business.
Thank you.
So that, committee, I will adjourn the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. The House Interim Committee on Business and Labor.